I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Fear was a key factor in many of the rebellions of the Arab Spring this past year. We saw how deeply authoritarian regimes can instill fear in their citizens. We also realized how quickly and decisively that fear of authority could crumble. David Kirkpatrick says he learned a lot about fear this year. Kirkpatrick became Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times just days before the Arab Spring started to sweep the region. He began his stint in early January with a trip to Tunisia. He says that at the time, people there feared even talking to outsiders.
The one local journalist I could get to talk to me would only speak with me walking at night along a darkened road so that he wouldn't be seen by the secret police. And then that afternoon, before Ben Ali's speech, I went out to visit. I'd seen a Facebook notice that there was going to be some kind of a protest or gathering in the beach town where the Ben Ali family had their summer homes, the town of Hammamet, sort of like the East Hamptons of Tunis. And I went out there. By the time I got there, not only had there been a gathering, but the people had risen up and pretty much chased away the police. A few officers were huddled around their station saying, no, leave us alone, don't attack us, go burn the family mansions. And that's, in fact, what they were doing. The protests were already looting the Ben Ali family mansions. And I thought, my gosh, this is really turned on its head. And they would show me pictures of themselves with videos they'd taken with their cell phones. And they would point to it and they would say, look, it's the people of Tunis, the people of Tunis. Here we are. And I went back to my hotel room to write what I thought was going to be a pretty good story about the looting in Hammamet. And Ben Ali, the president, came on the television. And you could hear that the fear had moved. The people weren't afraid, but he was. And he said, I understand. And you know what? From now on, you'll have more freedoms. You'll have the right to assemble. I won't send the police out to break up the crowds. Tunisians heard that as a green light, as an invitation to come out. And the next day, they pretty much filled downtown on Avenue Bourguiba in front of the Interior Ministry. It was wall-to-wall people calling for Ben Ali to leave. And the amazing thing was, even before he did leave, they were already talking like he had left. He was gone in their minds. It was over. And they were saying things already like, you know, what's happening here today is going to change the whole Arab world.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's a moment where the fear just gets transferred from the people to the executive, which is what happened in Egypt. Critically, on January 28th at the Khazar El Nile Bridge, you were there too. Tell us what happened and why that standoff was key to the Egyptian revolution.
Well, that was the day. The 25th of January was the day when the protesters first came out and really stunned the world with the breadth of the uprising, and I think surprised themselves. But that day was beaten back. By the 28th, which is now known as the Friday of Rage, everybody knew that it was on, so to speak. The Interior Ministry had turned off the internet and called out its troops and ringed Tahrir Square. The protesters had called everyone to meet at the mosques and march from there towards Tahrir. The Interior Ministry troops had deployed themselves at strategic locations to try to head that off. And on the Khazar El Nile Bridge, there were, I think, thousands of Interior Ministry troops with riot gear and clubs and rubber bullets and tear gas and water hoses positioned to beat back the protesters. And coming across the bridge, there was, again, thousands of unarmed protesters. And they surged forward against this wall of riot police. And they would get beaten back, but not all the way. And they would push back again. I couldn't believe it. Against the tear gas and against the rubber bullets and against the water hoses, they would push back against the mob of police. And it went back and forth all day, like a seesaw, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I realized, once the fear is gone, once the legitimacy of the government has collapsed completely, it takes an awful lot of rubber bullets and it takes an awful lot of tear gas to try to crush even an unarmed crowd. I think in that case, it would have taken a Tiananmen Square-style massacre, and I don't think the Egyptian government had the stomach for it. I don't think they could have gotten their troops to execute it, and who knows what kind of explosion it would have elicited from the Egyptian people. And by the end of the day, the police had vanished. They'd run off, and the unarmed protesters stormed across the bridge and made it to Tahrir Square, and they stayed there until Mubarak was gone on February 11th.
And then on to Libya, David, whose narrative took a much more violent path than Egypt and Tunisia. You watched the slow unraveling of the regime of Muammar Gaddafi. Tell us about that and what stands out for you.
Well, none of us were there. None of us Western journalists really were there the moment that things really broke because the Libyan state is so closed. I now know what it was like on the Friday after Mubarak fell, when people were – they were sort of terrified and didn't know what was happening, but they came streaming out of the mosques and they were chanting, these, the Libyans are these, ahum, ahum, al-Libyin, ahum, and they took over Tripoli. Just as in Cairo, the police fled. Tripoli was completely upside down. It was out of Gaddafi's control. He didn't really have an army. He had a series of militias controlled by his sons and his close allies. And they came in and they crushed Tripoli. And then, sort of astonishingly, he invited in the Western press. So I flew in on the 26th. The amazing thing was you could see they were still painting over the anti-Qaddafi graffiti. And there were even a few neighborhoods that still weren't yet under his control. So I always knew, having seen those neighborhoods and seen a couple towns that were still holding out against him before they were crushed, the peace that he had brought to Tripoli was brought at the point of a gun. It was all by coercion and intimidation. But then again, when it went fast.
I'm wondering, David Kirkpatrick, what you think the whole Libya experience tells us about the role of fear among these different groups in society and the internal divisions that are created as a result of that.
Well, Gaddafi, really from the moment he was challenged, stoked sort of tribal and regional fears. I mean, he was saying from the beginning, you know, to the tribes in the West that had always been loyal to him, that if you let these rebels, these tribes from the East take over, it's going to go ill for you. There was right. No idea of a nation the way there was in Tunisia or in Egypt. There was no sense of national unity. And so what was going on through the revolution and is still going on now in Libya is an effort to try to forge that sense of a national unit, of a national community where people are no longer afraid of each other and can try to discuss their differences civilly and elect a democratic government. And to be honest, it's still a long road there. We still see a very weak government struggling to control its own armed forces in the country really governed by a series of little city-states that led the rebellion. And it's not clear how they're going to finally submit to some national democratic authority.
David Kirkpatrick, Cairo bureau chief of the New York Times. He joined us from the Egyptian capital. Truly extraordinary year in the Arab world, David. Thanks for speaking with us about it.
It was my pleasure.